You're listening to the Australian Family and Fertility Law Podcast. Here's your host, Stephen Page.
Welcome to today's podcast with the Australian Family and Fertility Podcast. My name is Stephen Page, and I'm a fertility lawyer, and I've been around for many, many years. And I'm joined today by a colleague from Canada, Cindy Wasser. And Cindy, like me, is a parent through surrogacy, and recently we spoke on a webinar about Australian intended parents going to Canada. But that's not today's focus. Today's focus is about Cindy, because her story is truly an amazing one. So I want to throw it over to you, Cindy, to say hello and then tell us about how you got to become a lawyer in this space.
Thank you, Stephen. It's a pleasure to join you, and it's always a privilege to work with you, and I'm really honored that you thought of doing this with me. So let me give you a little bit of history. I was a criminal defense lawyer here in Toronto for almost 30 years, a very high-profile practice. I did a lot of international criminal law as well as the regular things here, but I was always in the news with my trials. I was the founding director of the Association in Defense of the Wrongly Convicted in Canada, argued many constitutional criminal law cases, and I had a real blessed career. I also remained a single woman through most of that time frame and was considered to be married to her career, in fact. Yeah. And so at the ripe old age of 42, I finally met my soulmate, and we knew right away we wanted to be together and have a family.
You just knew it.
First date. Yeah, yeah. and that was 17 years ago. So, yeah, that was my soulmate. Still is. So we started trying the traditional way, and I wasn't having much luck. I did get pregnant without trying initially and lost the baby at 7 weeks early in the pregnancy. And then we couldn't get pregnant again. So after all kinds of things, finally the doctors recommended we consider searching for an egg donor. And at that time, there were no agencies in Canada that helped you find donors. We had to find a donor ourselves.
And that would have been so hard. Where do you start?
It was crazy because I had this high profile career. It's not like I could take on another job of finding a donor. And my husband was a manager for mutual funds at one of the large Canadian banks. So it's not like he had a lot of time on his hands either, managing billions of dollars of money. So the clinics used to do it, but around that time in 2004, the Canadian law changed and made it illegal to get money for finding donors and surrogates. So the clinics dropped out of the business of matching. So they gave us hints, which is, you know, advertise in college and university newspapers. And that's what we did. And lots of young and flippant women responded to those ads and then never responded once we said hello. So it was disheartening as well as time consuming. And finally, one lovely young lady.
So if we just stop you there for a second. Mm-hmm. Now, you've been through trying naturally. That didn't work. And no doubt you're still trying naturally. And then gone through the roller coaster of IVF, where you climb up to the top of the hill and hope that this time the cycle is going to work, and then come crashing down the other side, the emotion of that, and then having been told, well, better do egg donation, and then you have this happen.
Yeah. And all the while, I'm doing these big trials, so I'm missing work time. I'm on hormonal drugs that make me super crazy because I was very sensitive to those drugs. And so I felt the need to share the personal business that I was enduring with the prosecutors and the judges, because it wasn't uncommon for me to literally lose it in the courtroom, and I needed everybody to understand you know, that, and I tried to manage it. If, you know, we were, there was a jury, we just took lots of breaks for me, but I was very hormonal. And so my business was everybody's business in the criminal law industry.
No one escaped.
Everyone knew, you know, it was like, oh, Cindy's going to try to get pregnant today. And then, you know, 2 weeks later, I had to tell everybody it didn't work. And everybody, you know, I had to tell 300 people all the time.
Oh.
So I had zero privacy. And it was emotionally draining. And then when I was told it's not going to be my biological child, I was crushed. And I don't think I had ever hit a lower depth emotionally than that. I understood that depression in that situation was nothing for me to worry about long term. I would overcome it one day, but it sure was blue at the time. It was pretty scary, and it was terrifying for my husband to see me that crushed.
This is the reality, isn't it? This is the reality for intended parents. How many times have you and I seen in our job that with heterosexual couples that typically or often his sperm will be used and she'll need an egg donor, and there really is such an emotional toll on the way through, because we expect that our genetic material is going to be used, and then to be told, sorry, ain't good enough.
Yeah, and it's, you know, what was hard for me is I think when I met my husband, Chris, at 42, I kind of knew we'd need help. But when we got pregnant the first try, when we weren't even really trying, that was the sucker punch, because then I thought, wow, I am very fertile. And then we couldn't. So I went through this process that was worse. But then came all the guilt and shame that my body was failing. I was using all our money for this. I was always worried about whether he wanted it as bad as I was, and I was depleting our financial resources. And you go through all that, and every female client I have has shared all of those experiences with me, or I've shared mine with them, and they've not been alone. But I was alone. Most of my friends were able, even with some help, to have their own children. Nobody needed an egg donor in my circle of friends when they made their children. I was so much older. At the time I was doing this, my friends' children were starting university, some finishing. So I didn't have a best friend who could say, yeah, I've been there through this whole thing. And I was very, very lonely in it. And one of the things that most men do that I see with my clients in my experience is that they then try to be the rock and don't share their emotional sadness. And
yeah, that's exactly right. Absolutely.
And the women want to see that. So yeah. I always tell my clients, be that. You can cry and you can be strong at different times. But, you know, with my same-sex couples, there's something else as well. It's not that struggle, but you know, you've struggled your whole lives from the time you realized that you were gay at a young age. If you're older, there was a great deal of shame, and even the younger groups, there's still been shame, because we're not in the perfect world yet. It's getting better, but that horrible shame at a young age is not something that people couldn't endure properly. I, at least at 44 years old, could get through it with maturity I had, and living in a country where I wasn't being a criminal for being barren. But, you know, so I think we still share a great deal of grief about trying to think about having a family when you can't. And then you grow up thinking, okay, so I'm gay, I'm never going to be a dad. And then the world did open up recently in most places, still not everywhere, but it's still such a struggle. And, you know, yes, you know, today the gay man can say, I can have a child, so I can, you know, accept who I am, know that I can make a family and go into it with that. But hey, it's still not easy. There's a political struggle.
You hit the nail on the head, you know, about the guilt and gay people, and you know, I've acted for a number of lesbian couples where they've needed to undergo surrogacy, and in turn they've needed an egg donor. And you just have to think how much guilt these couples have gone through, that it's taken as a given that a woman can, that her eggs are fine, she can get pregnant, and then they would have, the thinking would have been, well, if I can't, then my partner can, and then they discover that both of them were unlucky, and it really is that, isn't it? It's just a matter of luck that you can't determine. We can't greatly influence.
In my practice, which is mostly surrogacy, I don't see a lot of lesbian couples doing surrogacy, but I do occasionally get lesbian couples who need egg and sperm donors. Of course, they all need sperm donors, but both eggs, so that I have these two women who are saying, neither one of us can do this. And oh my God, double whammy, yeah. And they've lived with all of this other political shame all these years to get there. And I'm in Canada. In Canada, this has been more than tolerated. It's been accepted, you know, for so long now. Nobody notices and cares very much if you're a same-sex couple when you're walking down the street. It's, you know, I'm proud to say we don't care anymore. However, we are never giving up our Pride Week parade month anymore, because that's the most fun we have. So we're still trying to pretend that there's some political reason for a Pride parade, but it's just a good party. But yeah, so we go through all of that. And then, you know, it's very difficult. So we found this amazing...
You found this wonderful, amazing woman.
She is incredible. And then there's this very strange struggle that, again, is consistent amongst the, you know, the heterosexual couples, the woman, is that I love this angel. I am so grateful for the existence of this woman. I hate her. She's making a baby with my husband. So you have this devil angel, horrible guilt. Yeah. How can I be jealous and hate this woman who is giving this gift to me and putting her body through such risk and pain and misery for me, and I'm actually hating her, but I love her. And you struggle with that. So all I can say is therapy, 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 thousands of dollars of it, because you have to grow up and get over all of these things. And what I wish someone had said to me is what I say to people now. The minute you start this process, you are a parent. You're not becoming one, you are. So you need to start acting like it. And if someone had said to me on day one, be a parent now, I probably would have pulled up my socks a lot faster and got through so much of the grief, shame, guilt, all of it. Because as a parent, you know, we lift a school bus to pull our child out if we have to. And that's what you need to do when you're going through this process. Every day you're lifting up a school bus to get that kid out of there. And that's how you make your baby. You persevere. And so you don't have the luxury of licking your wounds every day when you're a parent. You don't get to have the flu if your kids all have the flu at the same time, do you?
No, you just got to get on with it.
You do. Get on with it. And so it begins with the making of the baby. That's parenting.
As you said, you've got to be resilient. If you don't keep at it, and if you're not resilient, you don't persevere, you may not get there.
Yeah. And somehow, it's just my nature. I am a resilient person. It's probably what made me a successful criminal defense lawyer.
Sure. But
that resilience, that strength and fortitude that I inherited from my ancestors who survived World War II in hiding got me through this. And I knew in my heart and soul that my life was not going to be complete if I didn't have a child somehow. And we did the adoption process. We went through all of it. We were number one on the list, you know, golden ticket parents for any birth mother, so we were told. But our laws say that a birth mother can change her mind in 30 days and take the baby out of your arms. And I have had puppies, and I've, you know, driven from the breeder to the vet to have my puppies checked. And I knew in that 5-hour drive that if the vet told me my dog was rabid and had 6 brain tumors, I was still keeping it. So because you fall in love. And I thought, how could I possibly give a baby back to somebody in a 30-day period? I'd be a fugitive. So I couldn't do the domestic adoption. My husband was actually very nervous about the openness of domestic adoptions in Canada. He didn't like the idea of it. He wanted choice. And so we looked at foreign adoption, which seemed insurmountable to us. The countries were limited. Our age also made it difficult. I couldn't foresee myself spending about 6 months in rural China by myself because he couldn't be there, figuring out what I was doing. And then, you know, there was options in a lot of third world countries where we were like terrified about the legalities of it. And I was still Cindy Wasser, famous criminal defense lawyer. I just couldn't be involved in some baby selling ring that I didn't know about. And I couldn't go and live there for the time period it would take. I was freaked out by all that. So the option really was this. So we met this egg donor. She remained anonymous initially. She wanted to know me. She wanted to know us, and I couldn't bear the thought of it. And I will tell you, the day that my husband made a baby with her was one of the worst days of my life. My head knew this was in a lab, in a dish. My heart saw them in some cheesy motel room. So I did.
Well, I was going to say, I hoped it wasn't in some cheesy motel room, but I'm glad it was in the lab. But I understand.
I did the only sane thing I could think of, which is what I tell my female clients they must do, is I went out and got 2 big boxes of Magnum ice cream bars and ate my way through it. So I got through that, and we had a lot of embryos, and then began the process of me trying to get pregnant with those embryos and using them one by one without success. And so at some point, the drugs were causing medical issues. My fibroids were growing dangerously close to my uterus. My doctor wanted me to have surgery. And fibroid surgery isn't that bad, except if you're trying to have a baby, then there's a worry of scar tissue. So you need to have a very invasive procedure called a myomectomy, where, you know, I will spare you the details, but the agony of this was unbelievable.
I've had a number of clients who've gone through that, and it's truly awful for them.
Yeah, I'm told it's worse than a C-section, although part of it is a C-section.
Yeah.
And so I was doing the myomectomy in the middle of this huge murder trial that actually went on for 18 months that I scheduled because the judge said he was taking 4 weeks off in August in the middle of this murder trial and rented a cottage. So I said, okay, I'll have surgery for my holiday. And little did I know, with this sensitivity I had to drugs, that I would also be very sensitive to the narcotics post-surgery. So I was almost like a stroke victim for 3 to 4 weeks, where I could barely speak. I spoke like this, searching for words. The doctors all said it'll wear off. So nobody was terribly concerned, except I couldn't work. So I would read case law, and I had no clue what I had just read. I could barely watch a TV show. I couldn't comprehend anything. I was literally brain dead. And so my law partners were preventing me from stepping foot in the courtroom. So I lost a lot of income as well, suffering physically, painfully. And my husband, of course, was watching all this and breaking inside, watching his wife suffer and just wanting to fix it, which, of course, he couldn't. But yet I persevered. I was determined to have this baby. So I did more IVF after that until we used the embryos. And I think I woke up one day and I just knew it was time to move on to the next stage, which was surrogacy for us. So now we needed to find a surrogate, and we had no more embryos. I wrote to the donor and asked if she would consider another donation. Unbeknownst to me, she had suffered tremendously after the retrieval with ovarian hyperstimulation. Never told me. The clinic never told me. I was sick to my stomach that she had gone through that, and I never knew. Never sent her, you know, flowers even. Of course, that would have been illegal, but I could have and I would have if I had known. And she was very unhappy with the clinic, and had done a donation for another couple in the interim at a different clinic that she liked. And so she was happy to do it again for me if I went to this new clinic. I was more than happy to do that. So we switched clinics. So now we had to go through all the process,
all the red tape all over again, and
just like
when you end up in hospital and you've got to tell the same story over and over and over again.
Yeah, which is annoying enough, but I wish that's all it was, because this red tape takes months to get through, not, you know, 20 more minutes of three nurses times an hour. So
yeah,
this took months and months and months of delay, and you just want to be a parent yesterday. And every minute is a year. Every month seems like an eternity when you're in this boat. So eventually we get there and we're looking for a surrogate. And we're told the clinic, there's really only one agency around at that time. I knew people who had done this, and they had been with this agency, and they had a lovely experience. So we signed up, and they introduced me to the lawyer they said was the best in the country. And there were very few lawyers who practiced in this area. And we met with her, and she showed me this legislation called the Assisted Human Reproduction Act of Canada. And so I went home and read it. And
the lawyer, of course you read it.
The criminal lawyer who helps write legislation for the Department of Justice frequently in the criminal code read this and said, what does this mean? And I said, this is completely unconstitutional, void for vagueness. I don't understand any of it. And I'm quite certain that no one in the Department of Justice in Canada has ever read this, let alone amended any of it. Who wrote it? And it was all the Department of Health. And, so I just said to this lawyer, how is this? Who's responsible for this disaster? And so it began, the legal element of this for me. And eventually, we began looking for a surrogate. The agency was not able to help us in a positive way. And our lawyer, after 2 years, suggested I look for a surrogate on Craigslist, which is an online buy and sell newspaper.
On Craigslist?
Yeah. I thought, well, you might sell your car or look for a dining room set. But this was a pretty awful idea to find a surrogate. But the world kind of knows that we lawyers make the worst clients, and I didn't want to be the worst client, so I decided to follow her advice, and I placed the ad, and we got one hit. One woman responded to our ad on Craigslist.
Wow. And
I went to meet her. She lived only an hour and a half east of Toronto. She had a lovely home, 4 young children. The house was spotless. They were lovely people. The kids were well cared for, very polite. We really hit it off, and we thought, wow, Lady Luck is smiling on us. And no one told me much more. She went for screening. She passed screening. The donor said she would do it again. At that point, I decided this woman needed to be thanked personally. So she became a known donor, and we met. And so began the beginning of an amazing relationship with her. I sort of think of her as a younger sister in some respects. She's just this very special person. I don't have a name because donor is too objective and cold. I don't call her the mother of my children or their biological parent, but she is so special in our hearts. She just is.
Well, it's an extraordinary thing, isn't it? When someone donates their genetic material, and particularly if they're a woman, potentially puts their lives at risk. And you've said yourself the first time around, you didn't know she had this risk to her health.
Yeah, and she is, just the most extraordinary, wonderfully warm, adorable person. And there's so little in life I wouldn't do for her. And so what turned out to be the best thing I ever did for myself and for my children I've learned in life is to have a known donor. So I do want to come back and talk about that as the children grow up, because I think those are important things. We don't know those things when we're making babies. None of us knows what it means to be a parent until it happens.
That's
to be in that privilege club is really awakening experience of responsibility and really learning that you don't count anymore. You put their interests ahead of yours. Is such a huge thing that you can't imagine until you're doing it. And so you have to with this. And so the donor and gave the eggs. We had new embryos. We did a live transfer back then, and the rest of the embryos were frozen in pairs as well. And our surrogate got pregnant right away. It was a weekend when the clinic called on the Friday to say the test was positive, but of course they don't call it a pregnancy until they do a second blood test the day in between. So they were trying to reach her to schedule that for Monday, and we couldn't reach her all weekend, and we left numerous messages for her. And then she left on the Sunday night a vitriolic message for me as well as for the nurse at the clinic. It was super crazy, and I realized, oh my God, there's something not right. And I told myself, she's just upset, you know, this was just a one-off. But I knew deep down inside, my instincts told me, this is not normal. And over the next,
this isn't just hormones from pregnancy. This is something more than that.
She was 1 day pregnant, right?
So yeah.
2 weeks.
Yeah.
So my instincts told me something was wrong. And don't forget, as a criminal lawyer, I've seen a lot of crazy. So I kind of knew it, but I didn't want to believe it in this case. And over the next few weeks, it became very clear to me. Within 3 to 4 weeks of the pregnancy, she had stopped communicating altogether with the clinic, barely communicated with us. I did my own diagnosis of a pathological liar. I had many clients who were, and then I had to be a mama bear because now we were pregnant and I had this carrying my baby. And I knew how to deal with that personality trait with my clients, but they're subjectively far away from me. I go home at night and it's their problem if they don't listen to me and they spend the rest of their life in jail. And
whereas here is a woman who is pregnant with your child.
Very different. And I had to figure that one out, plus being emotionally involved and being the criminal lawyer. So I was almost acting for myself, which is a big no-no.
Yeah.
And I had no support because no one could understand. None of my friends who were amazing could really understand this crazy situation. None of them, thankfully, had been in it. So again, lots of therapy. But I was being told that this has never happened. My lawyer could not do anything. This has never happened. This was over 12 years ago. My daughter's 12 and a half. To date, this is still known as one of the worst surrogacy journeys in Canada. I didn't want that crown, by the way. I'd happily give it to someone else. But I still carry the crown of worst surrogacy in Canada. The silver lining
Let's make this plain. Surrogacy journeys in Canada typically go really smoothly.
Yes, they do. 99% of them, except mine, and you know, a few glitches. Some of them have glitches, but this was horrendous. The silver linings were that I was a very well-known criminal lawyer, very well respected. So I was able to get help from the police, private investigators, prosecutors. I had a lot of people watching. And so I felt that my baby was careful, was being watched, and she would be careful. I also was told by the medical people looking after her that there was no harm to the fetus. This was a textbook growth pregnancy. So I had some relief about that, but I never knew. I mean, she could have decided to abort one day without telling me, because we can do that. I had to be on tippy toes all the time on eggshells.
Because, of course, she has bodily autonomy. She has control
over. Absolutely. A right I fought hard for, by the way, for Canadians.
I should say, so have I here. It's essential that she has control over.
It was an important right that I wanted her to have for all women, but not in my particular case. So I struggled with that, too. So, and then I have my husband, who is very mild-mannered about life in general. This was all foreign to him, and he was completely freaked out and left it all up to me to try to fix. But he just couldn't. He's still crushed by this. When you mention her name, he still shakes. So we got through it. She would say she had canceled appointments. There was no ultrasound. We would go. She'd show up. Like, I knew what to do. I knew it was lie, lie, lie. What color is your shirt, Stephen? Right now you're wearing a blue check shirt. She would say red for no reason. The color of your shirt is irrelevant to the pregnancy. She would just lie. What kind of cereal for breakfast? She'd lie. Doctor's appointment, yes, more relevant, she lied. But then she'd be there. And so she wasn't doing anything wrong other than the lying.
Yeah.
And it pathological. She could not help herself. And there were moments of lucidity, and she had four children. So I also felt horrible for her. I had empathy for her family, for her. In her moments of lucidity, it had to be hell. She didn't want to be this way. And obviously, some terrible trauma happened to her in her life that I never knew about. But I felt for this family. And she had a pretty ne'er-do-well husband, it turned out, and I just was heartbroken for these beautiful children. And so I did what I do best, which is I give. And I said, how can I help? Let me get you a cell phone. Let me get you this. Let me get you that. The car broke down. It was actually confiscated as unroadworthy. She lied about that. Let me help you buy a car. All probably illegal activity for me, but I spun the facts such that, you know, she needed a car to get to the doctor's appointments, to the clinic.
But this is not only spin, but this is reality.
Yeah.
You don't want to
going to arrest me for having the pregnant woman in a safe vehicle when she has 3-hour car drive to the clinic and then back.
You don't want her stuck in the middle of nowhere and then giving birth.
So, you know, my lawyer was saying this is all illegal and I'm going to put it in the contract. I'm doing it. And I will make it legal and I will fight it. And so, you know, I was telling my lawyer what to do. And it was very frustrating at all ends. And she, of course, the surrogate had her own lawyer who was completely freaked out about all of this and useless. And so I discovered that, you know, they had never had an uphill journey. And you can measure your success very easily if nothing ever goes wrong in life. You can say I'm number one. But to me, the measure of success is how you clean up a mess. And in criminal law, you have that opportunity daily. You always have witnesses who go south on you in the courtroom unexpectedly, and you have 2 seconds to fix it.
Exactly right.
You have to think on your feet. And so I could measure success easily, but I was aghast by this entire process. The lawyers, the agencies, the clinics, the law, all of it was a disaster to me. And I thought every day, this has to change. Every day for 9 months, this has to change, was my mantra amongst the other things I was going through. But I wasn't putting together what I was going to do. I just knew it had to change. And finally, after so much that I can't even get into, and so much that I had to do that I will never share with people publicly, but that I was able to do, Etta was born. And she was perfectly healthy and perfect.
Oh, wonderful.
And they brought her out at 37 weeks because the doctor was, it was before Christmas, the doctor wanted her on her last day of call to be there for the crisis that would otherwise ensue because the doctor knew what was going on. And as safe as it was 37 weeks, the last day that the doctor was on call before Christmas. So December 7th, 2008, our princess came, and she was just perfect, perfectly healthy, small, but healthy and wonderful, and we were discharged the next day. Right away, within the hour, I brought her into the surrogate's room to say thank you and had her hold Etta and say goodbye. You, the anger, the hurt melts away because you've got your perfect baby in your arms. And the surrogate stayed overnight, so in the morning I asked the nurse to let me know before she was discharged so I could visit again. And I made my husband go with me, and he said thank you, and she held her again. And I knew we weren't going to have a relationship. We needed to get the paperwork done for the registration. That was going to be hard enough. But I did what I had to do to get that done, and I won't share that. But, you know, within the hour of Etta's birth, right after that visit, I turned to my husband and I said, absolutely no one in this country should have to go through something like this to be a parent. Not in this country. This has to change, and I've just decided it's going to. And that
was watch out, Brussels sprout.
1 hour after birth, I became a fertility lawyer. That was the moment with her in my arms, right after the hug with the surrogate. This is going to change. And so began the journey. And, you know, I couldn't protest. I had to get a birth certificate. My husband, you know, worships the dollar. He needed the tax advantages. So I couldn't delay and fight the law. I had to go register this horribly insensitive way, which the lawyer also said, explained to me I would be going to family court, a place that criminal lawyers detest traditionally, and asking some family court.
I can say that that's the same in Australia too.
Yes, yeah, everywhere.
Yeah.
Same thing as like engineers and lawyers, but it, within law, family and criminal, it's like, how can you do that?
Yeah, why are you doing that? There's something wrong with you.
So I was being asked to go to family law court where a judge didn't know me, to ask a judge to name me as the mother of my husband's child. And I hit the roof, almost literally. And I said, at that point, I was 47 years old. I had been a criminal defense lawyer for like 20 years. More than half my life I devoted to justice to make this country better. And this was the first time I knocked on the door of justice for me. And it slammed in my face. And I went, are you kidding me? This will change. And so I began the process of changing the birth registration process and the recognition. And so we have the laws that say that we are parents at birth if you have a surrogacy agreement with lawyers and all the safety nets in the agreement. And that's really important to me. And I befriended the registrar when I had to register the birth because the forms were archaic and nonsensical. And, you know, my lawyer wrote affidavits for my declaration, and I read these affidavits that were my story, and I said, I don't understand my own affidavit. This is horribly written. So I rewrote my whole application. Then I called my favorite criminal law judge, Brian Trafford, less than my favorite, and said, you need to do my declaration of parentage. I'm not doing this in family court with some stranger. And he opened up the largest courtroom in Toronto, the one for the huge jury panels of 1,000 people. And we had every judge, prosecutor, we had over 50 people come. We had champagne, and he wrote this 10-page statement, because it's not a judgment. And he wrote about Etta's rights, her human rights as a child, to be recognized like no other child. And no one had ever, until that moment, spoken about the children that way. And that's what I brought to the table, that first change. And Brian Trafford was a judge who was so well respected that when he uttered those words, everyone said, yeah, we need to do something. He's right.
He's right. And you know, the focus is often on the surrogate, isn't it? And you know, surrogates are extraordinary women, but too often the focus of the law, as you've pointed out, hasn't been on the child.
No. And that actually is the best legal argument that we've made in Canada for any progressive change, including prohibitions and decriminalization. We don't talk about the adults. But when you talk about the baby and the rights of the baby, people listen. And you know, I can bring it full circle to what happened with COVID when Canada said we've got to get the parents into the country for the babies. The Prime Minister and Cabinet were up all night changing the law for the likes of foreign adults all over the world. No, Canadian babies deserved it. Their parents were foreigners, therefore we had to get them in.
Absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely.
So that's what it was. So, and that's how we worked it. So together we created this process slowly. And it's always been about that. And then, you know, when the Ontario law changed to have automatic recognition with administrative registration years later, unbeknownst to me, the forms changed. Nobody told us. And they actually had a question on the form saying, is this a surrogacy birth? Yes, no. And I hit the roof again. Are you stamping these children surrogacy birth? And this form comes back signatured, stamped as your long form birth certificate, which at the time you needed for the passport. So it was used to get a passport, which meant the passport information on the computer system, not in the physical passport, but you know, in the computers when scanned.
These children are marked for life. It's as though they have a mark on their forehead.
Exactly. And nobody saw that but me. Everyone's going, yeah, statistics, we understand you got to keep statistics. And yes, Canada has to report surrogacy births to the World Health Organization, maternal fetal health, all very important. But there was another way to do that, specifically since one of the forms to register is called the Statutory Declaration by Surrogate.
There's the form, not to mark the child for life.
So you have a form signed by the surrogate. Don't you know it's a surrogacy birth? And you have all these records at the hospital. You have so many ways of putting in a piece of paper to the World Health Organization. It was a surrogacy birth, and this is how much the baby weighed, and it was all good. So that we held a meeting with the registrar general herself, and I screamed and yelled and said, I was very, very emotional in it. And I said, the babies. And they changed the form again because of that. And they can keep their stats without that. So there is no paperwork that's registered, that's public, that says donor or surrogate in Canada. Nobody would know unless you choose. So, of course, I'm very vocal about mine. My children are turned out to be the most famous surrogacy egg donor babies in the universe, probably, even though I fought for their privacy so much. But as I say, it's my private right. It's their private right. It's no one's to just decide it. And so we also have a process with our courts where we would have the records sealed, although a lot of judges aren't about publication bans and sealing orders, but it is available. And I've had this debate with journalists who say why these things should be public record. We should be able to go to the courthouse and look at all the applications for surrogacy declarations. And I say, what is the national interest in knowing how my baby was born? Is there a national interest in me knowing how you conceived your child? I'd like to see a video of you and your husband having sex each and every time. You know, there's no national interest. You know, so mine was,
and you're saying that with a straight face.
I did, and it was a very legitimate argument. It shut them up. And there isn't a national interest. What is the national interest is that it can be done. Not that I had it done, that you had it done, or anyone in particular. It is done, and it is legal. And that
the child's rights to privacy are protected.
That is a great national interest. And, you know, unless the child has a parent like me who makes their private interests very public. They mostly are very private. And so that's sort of how it began for me. And in the 12 years that I've been practicing in this field, because I've always been lobbying for the change and making it more public, even though demanding privacy, my practice has just grown. My firm is the largest, busiest fertility law firm in Canada. I'm still devoted to public change. You know, I like being public about my journey for a number of reasons. It helps other people, I've learned that. But the selfish reason was to make life normal for my children. The more people who do something, the less abnormal it is.
That's
to
right.
The point where, you know, who cares? And
yeah.
One of the things I like to describe this process of family making as in Canada is like going to your huge grocery store and going to the dairy department and looking at the fridge with the various types of milk and other milk type products there are. There are like 50 to 100 different products out there, and we don't all have to drink them. And, you know, I don't care for almond milk. I drink soy milk, and my children have 2% milk, and people give their kids chocolate milk, and there's goat's milk, and there's cashew milk, and there's whatever milk you like. And I'm glad there's a choice of milk for everything. And when I have guests, I'm happy to buy 6 different kinds to accommodate a house full of guests when that day can happen again. So it's a beautiful world that there's so many products out there, and family making in so many ways is great. And my children were made their way, but we're still a family. And that's what Canada is about. And so I've been able to use those arguments to affect change. And, you know, the other thing that works politically is money. Birth registration administratively costs the government far less money than using a court and the judge's time. And the judges were all for that. As much as they loved doing this precious work, they were busy. And they were like, every morning they were spending an hour with a lawyer doing, you know, 6 declarations. And it was lovely, certainly better than going into family court for the rest of the day. I'll go back to that. But, you know, but they had to do that work, and it was time consuming. So it's a win-win, and it's still available for foreign clients who need a court order. So they still get to do them. So I'm seeing the provinces make those changes. I can't affect them in other provinces politically, but I can be a loud voice. And I have a colleague in Alberta who I am shaming into trying in making this change in a positive shaming way, because we're friends. But, you know, she has to push this because it's just the right way to do it, thinking about the children. And in some provinces like Alberta, it's considered unwise politically to fight in the current administration. But I think even this administration would agree that the children should be treated better and would consider it. So that's my goal, is to keep pushing province-wide, Canada-wide. And so with COVID, when we had the Immigration Act changed to allow foreigners in for the birth, they had to, first the change was that parents could come in to unify with their babies, but these weren't people yet because they weren't born, and we needed you here before the birth because there was a 2-week quarantine, and babies come early, so we actually needed you here several weeks.
They often do that, don't they?
They do. And so we had a conundrum, because if the baby's not born in Canada, it's not a person, therefore you're not a parent of a person. So they had to make a second amendment that said you are considered a parent for surrogacy birth in advance. Very scary amendment, because we are very careful about our abortion laws and we aren't calling that fetus a person ever. So they worked super hard on those amendments for all of those reasons. And the Department of Justice was very much involved in this one for sure. And it was well worded and carefully worded. and I knew for 9 days what was going on. It was all clandestine, and I didn't breathe for 9 days during that period. You and I spoke a lot during that.
We did.
Yeah, me in pajamas Friday nights, you Saturday mornings.
Right, I remember it well.
I was pulling my hair out. And so a month later, I got contacted by the ministry official. She said, I want you to watch the news at 10 o'clock this morning. This one's on you, for you. And they changed the Immigration Act again. They did a complete overview of it since they started looking at it. And there's a law in Canada that said if you have a baby abroad, you can only bring it home and give it Canadian citizenship if you yourself are a natural born Canadian. So I could have, if I was the genetic mother of a baby born in Kenya through surrogacy, I could give it Canadian citizenship. But in my case, I wouldn't have been able to do surrogacy abroad and give it Canadian citizenship, although my husband could have.
Yes.
And there are people who didn't know that. Then there's the person who says, I am Canadian and I am the sperm donor or egg donor, but they realize they're Canadian because of their parents. They weren't born here. They could not give citizenship. So we had a few of these situations arise where the government had to step in and use extraordinary means to grant citizenship against the law, and with a veto power and very political means. And it sometimes took a long time. And there was this scandalous situation in India years ago. It took the family 10 years. So they looked at what was going on with the surrogacy amendments and said, it's time to fix. As Cindy says, it's about the Canadian baby. And so they amended it again that day in April to say, you no longer need a genetic connection to be considered a parent in Canada. This one brought me to my knees because I'm not the genetic parent of my children. And I was granted status as a parent by this disgusting law. And I shouldn't have to be granted. It should have been. And we have provinces that demand there be a genetic connection. That is now unconstitutional because the federal law says, no, it's not. And so I am desperate for the lawyers in those provinces to bring those arguments. And I'm finding my way to push it. But having just turned 60, I am getting tired. So I pick my battles. But my province is very progressive, and that won't change. So the journey, you know, was enormous for me at so many levels. So much came out of that grief. I made lemonade big time.
what's plain is that your what started out as a personal journey became a professional journey, and passion not only for your children but for others to make sure that
worldwide it's enormous what's happened. I have traveled to so many countries to speak about my journey and surrogacy law in Canada, and have, you know, seen people cry in my arms and say thank you, and for many people, I'm the first person who gets it in their lives. You know, I'm the person that I didn't have. And so I get that. And my story, you know, was published in a major magazine here when Etta was 5, so 8 years ago. The most incredible thing that I never imagined when I did the story was that a couple read it. Their surrogate was then 32 weeks pregnant, and they read it line by line, 5 pages, and wondered how I knew what was going on in their surrogacy. It was identical, every single bit. Wow. And so they contacted me through the journalist, and it turned out they had the same surrogate. It's an MO, right?
Wow.
Logical. And she is allergy pediatric specialist, and he's a corporate lawyer at one of the humongous corporate law firms. So again, not vulnerable people, generally intelligent people, completely freaked out. And I guided them through the next 8 weeks of their pregnancy. I told them everything that was going to happen as it was happening. It was uncanny. And because it's a small world in Toronto, the city of 4 million, they happen to live only a few blocks away from me and go to the same farmer's market in the park that we do. So our children have grown up as womb mates. And I was able to guide them for the second baby through to an agency. And because, of course, they had a lawyer, I acted for their Second Circuit, who was beautiful, and I got to be part of their legal process as well. So it was lovely. I never dreamed that I would be able to help so directly a couple going through the same nightmare. So I share the worst journey with other people, I might say. I should correct that. But theirs ended up with at least 8 weeks of calmness. You got to be careful finding a surrogate online.
Well, on that extraordinary note, I think we'll finish. We're well and truly over what was our time, and it's extremely late for you in Toronto at the moment. But as always, Cindy, it has been a delight to talk with you today.
My pleasure, Stephen. Thank you so much.
And you've been listening to the Australian Family Law and Fertility Law podcast.
Thanks for listening. If you have any questions, please don't hesitate reaching out to Stephen at pageproven.com.au.